From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, two hosts from Pod Save America discuss their live HBO shows and launching their company after the 2016 election.
We started Crooked Media because we believed it was important to create a place where people could be informed, entertained, but also inspired to get involved.
Then why are there so few disabled characters and disabled actors playing them on screen?
The idea that the next door neighbor or the pizza delivery guy might be visually impaired or deaf, these kinds of things just don't get seen in television.
All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. In the wake of the 2016 election, it's fair to say that many people reconsidered their relationship to politics. The hosts of the podcast Keeping It 1600 went a step further. They created a new podcast called Pod Save America, and with it, they launched the company Crooked Media. Now they produce 10 podcasts, and tonight they air the first of four live Pod Save America shows on HBO. The hosts are former members of the Obama administration, and their political bent is no doubt progressive. They are Dan Pfeiffer, a strategist and former director of communications, Tommy Vitor, who worked in communications and national security, and the speechwriters Jon Favreau and John Lovett. We recently visited the Crooked Media offices in L.A. to sit down with the two Johns, and Favreau started with what they can do with a podcast that they couldn't do working in politics.
We may be reaching a different audience, or at least a more expansive audience than if we were on a Senate campaign, on a congressional campaign. Look, that's sort of the nature of a bunch of people started listening since we started Pod Save America. Now we have this big audience, and we talk about giving people an on-ramp to politics. And so there's a lot of people who've never been involved in politics before who, if they hear a bunch of people joking around about politics, making it entertaining, making it fun, they might start listening to a podcast. And they might not listen as closely if, say, like the DNC puts out a press release or some candidate puts out a press release, you know? And so I think there's a media function to what we're doing, obviously, that because we have this larger audience now, then we might be able to bring more people into the process.
You have shared on the pod how Crooked Media was started with your going to the bank with, I think, $100.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a little bit of that recollection that you shared with your audience.
A year ago, John and Tommy and I were sitting around a kitchen table at John's house thinking...
Just talking about kitchen table issues.
Talking about kitchen table issues.
Your jobs, like, your wages, your health care.
And, you know, we went to Bank of America with a $100 bill and we said...
What was her name?
Give us... Olga.
Olga.
Helga?
Helga.
Either one works.
It was Olga.
For the story.
And we said, Olga, here's $100. We'd like to start a bank account for a little company called Crooked Media. We're just three guys with a podcast idea.
Just three bozos.
Three bozos. Two from Boston.
We got a pun and a dream.
And 100-something episodes later, here we are.
Now you've got a big office. You've got, almost a dozen podcasts now.
Yeah, 10 podcasts.
You've got HBO shows. You've got merch. You've got live shows, international tours. Obviously, that probably wasn't the plan or the outcome that you expected so soon. So what do you think's driving it?
Well, we didn't go into this with a plan. I mean, we really didn't. And I think
you could hear from that.
Yeah, I mean, that was our plan. I think we felt two things really deeply. One, that the conversation around politics was broken. And two, that Trump becoming president was a national crisis and we wanted to be involved. And we bet that there were a lot of people out there that felt the same way we did, that they felt as though the conversation around politics was often very self-serious without leaving you feeling like you not only understand what's going on, but know what to do about it. The way we talk about it sometimes is there's incredible reporters and anchors and journalism on television. This is not a too broad a brush, but at times when you're watching punditry, no matter what medium it's in, you feel like you're being talked to less like a frustrated participant and more like a cynical observer. And we wanted to make sure that we were always talking to people as frustrated participants, that you're not some disconnected person out there. We're all part of this fight.
You're 3,000 miles or so from Washington. Do you think there's a perspective that the geographic location of Crooked Media gives you as thinkers, as podcasters, in the way you approach stories?
I think anywhere outside of Washington gives you that perspective. Anywhere outside of Washington and New York, we've been there. I lived there for 10 years. You not only watch all the same media, watch all the same cable news programs, read all the same stuff. You also see all those people socially, or when you're out and about, or through work. And so it is all the same reporters talking to all the same political staffers, talking to all the same pundits, and there is a groupthink that still exists in media for anyone who uses Twitter, for sure, no matter where you live. But it is way more intense in Washington, D.C. than it is outside.
A podcast is, I think, by definition, intimate. I mean, here we are talking around this round table. And when you're doing something public, like a live show, it's a very different kind of set of rules. So I want to play something, love it, that you said on the pod a little more than a year ago. It was right after the Las Vegas shooting.
What's so frustrating about this is this will happen again. Oh, this is the worst one ever. It won't be for long. It won't be for long. More people will die. And then you'll see the politicians say, there's just no words. Why don't you have words? Why? Are you surprised? You shouldn't be. Shouldn't be surprised at all. It's going to happen again. It's going to happen in a month. This is giving somebody else an idea. Somebody is going to watch this, and they're going to have the idea, and nothing's going to stand in their way.
John Lovett, I remember listening to that in my car, and I drove two exits past where I was supposed to get off because I was with you in that moment. How do you retain what is so important to a lot of listeners of the pod when you're doing a live show? Is it even possible to have that kind of personal connection?
The truth is, you asking this question is the first time I've ever thought about that distinction between the intimacy of the studio and what happens on stage in terms of connecting with people, because I think one of the reasons that the live shows have been successful, the reason I think people come to them, is because they feel like listeners and they want to kind of be part of this community of people that are all listening. I mean, yeah, when we do it in front of an audience, there's applause and there's laughter and you can hear that. But I think one of the goals of the live show is to kind of have the same honest conversation in front of people as we do when there's nobody there. And in terms of what that clip was, I mean, one of the things about this, whether it's a live show or not, is it's a chance to really talk about how you're feeling right then. And that's what that was.
Coming up on The Frame, more with John Lovett and Jon Favreau. Their podcast, Pod Save America, airs a live show on HBO tonight.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. And now we'll get back to my conversation with Pod Save America co-hosts John Lovett and Jon Favreau. They, along with fellow co-host Tommy Vitor, are the founders of Crooked Media. When we visited their offices in L.A., I asked them how they tried to get out of their white male bubble to include more diverse voices in the Crooked Media universe. Here's John Lovett.
We started the podcast as a hobby, right? And its success, I think, raised those kinds of questions, which are totally legitimate questions. And I think that there's a few different ways. One, we immediately wanted to make sure that what Crooked Media puts out there isn't just us. And now it's not. It's 10 different shows. We also launched with Duray McKesson Show, Anna Marie Cox. Now there's Keep It with Ira Madison and Louis Vertel and Cara Brown. There's been a bunch of different shows. So that's just also making sure that there is a range of voices and perspectives that are the face of this network. On top of that, one thing we've also, I think we take a lot of pride in, is we've built an incredibly diverse team here. And I think even though we knew it was the right thing to do, and even though we knew it would lead to positive things for the company, I have to say, one of the most amazing things about working here is how that diversity builds on itself and exposes you to different ideas and different people. Like, I host the show Love It or Leave It, and I've learned so much from the panel we have every week because we have these incredible producers that are really tapped into this diverse audience and this diverse group of talented people. And I think that's made the whole network stronger, and it's made our discussions richer.
We also try very hard to talk to guests from all kinds of different backgrounds, diversity of thought, diversity of background, And so it is something that we think about all the time. Look, I mean, the podcast started, Pod Save America started because the four of us were friends who got an opportunity to yell about politics on the microphone, and someone gave us that opportunity. And so that's how it started. If we were starting from scratch, you know, it probably would have been a more diverse crew from the get-go, but it started with the four of us. And then we decided to make a conscious decision that because we are four white dudes doing Pod Save America, every decision we make past that initial decision to have the four of us on the show, we're going to try to make sure we reach out to as many people as possible from as many backgrounds as possible.
So you're doing an HBO live show. What does that mean for your listeners, for your audience? I know Game of Thrones is maybe going away for a little bit. Is this going to goose the ratings for HBO?
This is the Game of Thrones replacement.
It's the Game of Thrones of lighthearted political conversation. We're doing these four specials with HBO. We're going to be doing them in Philly and Austin, Irvine, California, and Miami. We're going to be talking to candidates. We're going to be talking to people on the ground. We're kind of taking the live shows that we've been doing since we launched Pod Save America to a new audience. And as part of that, we've launched something called Vote Save America, which is we were sort of trying to figure out how we could help. And we're like, well, there must be a site where you can register to vote, check if you're registered, see what's on your ballot, find out about volunteering. That's kind of all in one place. And it turns out it really didn't exist. And so with the help of our incredible team that has worked so hard on this, turns out the reason it didn't exist is because it's incredibly hard. But they built this resource called Vote Save America, where people can go, you can pledge to vote, you can find ways to volunteer, you can find out what's on your ballot, you can see what's going on in your state, sort of all in one place.
Favreau?
Yeah, I mean, look, Vote Save America is, we're very proud of it because, I think we have something like over 100,000 people have already pledged to vote, which is great. And the thing that's coolest about it is people are going to be able to download their ballots on their phone, and we're going to annotate it for them so they know exactly what these ballot measures are and who they're voting for, from congressional level and gubernatorial level right down to their district attorney. And so, you know, it's a resource that we're pretty excited about, and we'll be talking about it during the HBO shows as well.
So the HBO shows are certainly a validation of your popularity, but how do you guys measure your own success? What do you see as the takeaways from what the pod and its offspring can do?
More people involved in politics, more people voting, especially young people, more people paying attention to politics, and not just around an election time, but all year round. That to me is a measure of success.
Yeah, that was good. Let's go with that.
John Lovett and Jon Favreau are co-hosts of the podcast Pod Save America, which tonight airs its first of four weekly live shows on HBO. And now the conversation about diversity in Hollywood often leaves out one very important group, and that is people with disabilities. The organizers of the Real Abilities Film Festival, that's Real, R-E-E-L, are looking to change that. While the festival has been around for more than a decade, it's in Los Angeles for the first time this week. Ahead of the festival's kickoff yesterday, I sat down with writer-producer Deborah Calla, who's chair of the Media Access Awards, and actor Danny Woodburn. Woodburn, who has dwarfism, is vice chair of SAG-AFTRA's Performers with Disabilities Committee. We started with a troubling statistic about the 100 most popular films of 2017. Researchers at the USC Annenberg Inclusion Initiative found that only 2.5% of all characters in those films were depicted with a disability, and yet people with disabilities make up almost 19% of the U.S. population. I asked Deborah Calla what those numbers mean to her.
When writers are writing scripts, they don't think about creating characters with disabilities. When casting directors are casting, they don't think about bringing actors with disabilities for parts that could be played by any person. And when producers and directors are also coming in, they're not thinking about including people with disabilities. So what we are trying to do, all of us activists for people with disabilities, is to alert, remind, educate, and demand that people with disabilities are seen in media to reflect the world we live in.
And Danny, what do those numbers mean to you as an actor?
Well, when I think about the numbers you just said, you talked about the 2.5% of the characters.
True.
But see, we're just talking about characters.
We're not talking about who plays them,
who plays those characters. And if we go back as far as, say, the GLAAD report of 2010, which first incorporated disability into their study in television of Where Are We Now, that number, let's say there was six actors, characters on television with disability at the time in series television, prime time. So of that six, one at that time, Robert David Hall from CSI, was the only actor with a disability playing one of those six. Now, I think those numbers have moved up a bit in terms of characters, but the actors portraying them, we're still looking at a similar percentage.
And yet, if you cast a Caucasian actor as an Asian character, you hear generally from a lot of people complain about it. But if you cast an able-bodied actor as somebody with a disability, it doesn't really rise to the same level of complaint, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't get the same kind of press that a character who is not the right race gets. People sort of object to the idea. Then they go back to the argument of, well, it's just acting. But you can say that, but you have to say that across the board. And you also have to consider the kinds of opportunities that are available for actors with disabilities. For example, you look at the classic Hollywood bungalow casting session or the old Hollywood studio with old buildings that aren't necessarily ADA compliant, and you have auditions up on the second floor with no other access, you are immediately saying, without saying the words, no one with disability is coming to this audition, because it's an unconscious thought for the casting director or the producer to say, well, I don't know how they're going to get up here, so they're just not going to bother calling them in.
I want to step back and talk more broadly about how we define people with disabilities, because I think certain people have certain ideas fixed in their mind. How would you define it, and what would it and should it include?
People with disabilities include people with physical and intellectual disabilities. And if a person identifies himself or herself as a person with disabilities, that is the acceptable qualification for a person with disabilities. So the same way as a person with their sexual orientation, they identify themselves as gay or straight, or so it is up to the person. If it is a disability that is not visual.
You are both participating in a panel at the festival called The Final Frontier: Disability and Inclusion in Entertainment. The festival has been around for a while, but it hasn't been in LA. Why is it important that this conversation and this festival is around Hollywood, where people should be and might start thinking about the issues you're raising?
Oh, it's super important because we learn from what we see in television and film. So this festival is going to be showing films that have characters with disabilities, that have actors with disabilities, that have writers that have created these characters, and is going to give the opportunity to have this conversation amongst the community as well as people that are interested in the subject of really inclusion of people with disabilities in media and thus in society.
And this is the town where the decision makers are. And so when we can incorporate that conversation, to have that conversation with decision makers who are willing to have it, then that makes this movement forward all the more powerful.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Deborah Calla and Danny Woodburn about the inclusion of people with disabilities in Hollywood. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll return now to my conversation with two advocates for people with disabilities in Hollywood, writer-producer Deborah Calla and actor Danny Woodburn. The Real Abilities Film Festival, which highlights work by disabled performers, is in L.A. this weekend. Woodburn, who's a little person, has had a long career in film and TV. Several people in our office recognized him from his work on Seinfeld. He played aspiring actor Mickey Abbott. In this scene, Mickey and Kramer talk with Jerry and George about Kramer's new job.
You got a job?
Yeah, Mickey, he hooked me up. We're stand-ins for the actors on All My Children. Mickey, he's a stand-in for an 8-year-old kid, and I stand in for the kid's father.
But I got a big problem. The kid I stand in for, he's growing. He was 4 feet last month. Now he's like 4'2½". He shot up 2½ inches. I could do 4'2". 4'3"'s a stretch. Any higher than that, I'm gonna be out of my ass doing that paralegal crap.
How do you stop a kid from growing? I told you, you should offer him some cigarettes.
I offered him cigarettes, but his stupid mother's always hanging around.
So I have a couple questions about that. First of all, did you feel that that was a good representation of a person who wasn't defined by his disability?
I do. You know, as the clip goes on, Jason Alexander's character, George, refers to my character as a midget, which, you know, has been a derogatory term for like 40 plus years, as far as people in the little people community are concerned. And so, because Seinfeld was never a show, like, there was never, like, a very special episode of Seinfeld, and they will say that, we had to work out a way in which I addressed that without making it preachy and without making it, you know, some other kind of show. So what happened was it sparked sort of a violent rage in Mickey.
It's little people. You got that?
Easy, Mickey. Easy.
And then Kramer says, easy, Mickey, easy. And that, because of that little conversation that I had with Jerry and Larry, that, you know, I didn't want to just let that word go. Because of that conversation, the character itself was sort of born. Like, the violent nature of Mickey was born out of that conversation. So when we open the door to have conversations about disability, other things come from that.
One of the things that I think this and other parts touch on is this idea that the character should not be defined by how he or she looks. That the script could call for somebody to play the president, and it could be a woman. The script could call for somebody to be the head of a Fortune 500 company, and it could be an African American. And yet, I think so often, people with disabilities don't get to play people who are not defined by their disability. Is that part of the problem?
I think I've been lucky enough to make headway in my own career with regard to that. But I think that is part of the problem. The idea that the next door neighbor or the pizza delivery guy might be a visually impaired or deaf or a double amputee pizza delivery guy. You know, these kinds of things just don't get seen in television. And I think it has to do with who's writing the shows. So, for example, Glenn Mazzara, he runs a showrunners sort of class, and he brought me in, gratefully, to have a discussion with his students regarding depictions of disability. But he also said, you know, you have to welcome conversations with women in the room, and you have to welcome conversations with people of color into the room. And if they're not there, they've got to be represented somehow. So as a result of that, the WGA, I know, was pushing an initiative to create a tax incentive law, I think, in the state of New York, to any production company that worked with writers of color or women would get some kind of tax initiative. But my complaint to that was we were not addressing writers with disability. And a lot of times the back talk to that, the argument to that is, well, if the person who's disabled happens to be a woman or happens to be a person of color, then it's fine. But that's not really how the marginalized aspects of disability works. It's not specific to that.
And Deborah, I think this is a very important point, and that is that it's not just about what we see in front of the camera, it's about who is making the creative decisions behind the camera. That if that group of people isn't diverse, then the stories that they are going to tell naturally, I think by default, isn't going to be that diverse as well.
Absolutely, because I am involved in the community of people with disabilities, every piece of every project that I get involved with, I make sure that there is a character with disabilities, and that's because I am thinking about it. So what we deal with constantly is unconscious bias. So what Denny said about Glenn, is really important because it all starts with the writing, and Glenn Mazzara is a showrunner, and together with Shonda Rhimes and maybe five or six other folks, there is a committee at the Writers Guild that is going to the studios, that is talking to other showrunners and saying, hey, when you create stories, when you populate your writer's room, you must populate, you should populate with people that are different than yourselves, not because it is the kind thing to do, but is the best thing to do, because we bring in stories that are particular to our human experience.
What I've seen happening in the last few years, too, is some of the studios are opening their doors more and more to this conversation. For example, NBC Universal is sponsoring us for the Real Abilities Film Festival, as well as CBS Diversity Inclusion. So this is sort of a great transformation that I feel is happening right now. And I'm excited by the idea that this continues and that we don't just keep creating initiatives of diversity that are exclusive of people with disability.
Danny and Deborah, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
The Real Abilities Film Festival continues through Sunday. You can find more at Real Abilities, that's R-E-E-L, abilities.org. And that is it for this week. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back here on Monday.